Well, the latest building approvals for Australia show just how bad the housing situation is becoming. No wonder it's taking a while for inflation to come down. We'll dissect that. PMIs in Europe have been by and large revised up. So what does that do for the likelihood of a June rate cut? We'll look at that. Well, they're certainly going to be waiting longer in the United States. How long? Well, maybe the jobs numbers tonight will have a bearing on that, and the wages data as well. It's Friday. It's the 5th of April, 2024. It's the Morning Call from NAB. Good morning. Well, it was a mixed session for US shares, not quite at the close yet, but the Dow, which was up 0.5%, is now down 0.3%, a 0.25% rise in the S&P, and 0.3% for the NASDAQ. That was up over 1% earlier on, so a bit of unbridled enthusiasm, then a reality check, perhaps. I mean, look at this. Microsoft was up almost 2%, and it's come back to 0.5%. Meta was up 2.7%, but was up almost 4.5% earlier, and Tesla has fallen back from 4.8% to an increase of just 2.8%, so pretty choppy in the last hour or so of trade. In Europe, the gain are smaller, although the FTSE 100 is up 0.5% at close. The DAX is up 0.2%. The Eurostox 50 only just in the green. 10-year Treasury yields are down 1 basis point to 4.33%. Bond yields are down 3 basis points for 10 years in the UK and Germany. Aussie 10-year yields around 4.15%, which is a few basis points lower than yesterday. And a small fall in the US dollar is down 0.1% on the DXY this morning. The euro is up 0.2%. The pound is pretty flat. The Aussie, well, it's a standout again. It's up 0.6% to 66 US cents. And oil, well, that was falling back a bit today. Then it leapt up late in the session. So WTI is up 0.8%. Brent is up 1%, up to 90 a barrel now. And gold came back off its high, only to then jump back up again, up 0.1% now. So something is happening late in the session. Let's talk through it all with NAB's Rodrigo Cotril. So I'm trying to figure out, particularly this movement in commodities, is this just a bit of, but it's also hitting shares. So is this positioning ahead of non-farm payrolls, or is it geopolitics related, of which there's quite a bit around this week, isn't there?
Yes, morning, Phil. It's been quite a, as you say, choppy markets, in particular now in the last half an hour or so. We've seen sentiment turned lower and the equity market effectively erasing all those gains. When you look at the headlines, we've had quite a lot of central bank speakers, quite a lot of Fed speakers, but in the last half an hour to 45 minutes, we had two Fed, Mester and Kaskari, and both of them throwing caution to the air in the sense that, again, arguing that more progress is needed in terms of services inflation, and Kaskari in particular, noting that, you know, the top rate cuts may be delayed because of the how well the market is doing. So overall, it's a reflection of how sort of nervous the market is in terms of what the Fed may be doing. And again, of course, we have non-farm payrolls tonight. So that's an important indicator in terms of how the U.S. economy is traveling. And as you mentioned, too, there's this other dynamic going on in oil prices, which, again, is not just a combination of an increase in demand and inflation, but also that geopolitical aspect or angle, which, of course, is a major concern, too.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how all that unfolds. Let's go back to yesterday, though. Karma times. And Australia's house housing numbers from yesterday. Well, apartment numbers, really, because that's what was dragging things down, wasn't it? With building approvals down 2.9% month on month in February, but apartments down almost 25%.
Yes. So I suppose the first point to make there that apartments are a volatile series. So you do get these lumpy gains and losses. But overall, I think that the major takeaway in terms of what's going on with building approvals in Australia is that they continue to decline. And we have now 163,000 dwellings approved in the past 12 months. And that is the lowest number since March 2013. So that's huge.
Yeah. And yet 619,000 extra people over the age of 15.
So we talk about the cost of living, we talk about house prices and inflation, and now you realize, well, in Australia, we have a structural issue. You know, these inflationary dynamics coming from the housing market are here to stay for some time because of the issue around supply. You can't fix them very quickly, and as evident in building approvals, whilst at the same time you have this ongoing demand from population growth. So Again, makes the job a little bit harder for the RBA when it starts considering about this idea of bringing inflation down when you have something that has continued to push prices up in terms of cost of housing, rent.
Well, shouldn't they ignore that? I mean, if that is a factor that we know is due to supply and demand in the housing sector, and we know that rental prices, for example, continue to be very sticky, we know why that is. It's because this shortage of dwellings. So can they discount that from the, you know,
I'm not sure I agree with that. So like, okay, let's discount all the prices that go up and therefore inflation is in the good place and there's nothing to do.
Well, no, but the ones that, I mean, but how, what influence do they have? What can they do that is going to change the rising cost of housing?
No, so I think that the general sense from a central bank perspective is that you look at the overall inflationary pressures, and if they are elevated for whatever reason, then it is a concern. And whether that reason is a structural one, then it means you need to run policy tight for longer. Because ultimately, it's about the idea that if you have elevated inflation above this ideal level, which in Australia we think is around 2.5%, then the impact on the economy and potential growth and outlook for the economy is not a good one, because it creates instability, uncertainty, and so on. So you have to bring it down to a level that is a little bit more tamer of that 2.5%. So
yeah, but then if that means that you want to get rents down, that's not good for the landowners, is it? For the property owners?
Yeah. Yeah, but the RBA will say, well, we make policy for the whole economy, not for individual sectors within the economy.
This housing shortage certainly is going to impact inflation numbers, isn't it? So the 24th is when we get the next inflation numbers for Australia, and I think we are expecting there's going to be a bit of an uptick, aren't we?
Yeah, so for Australia, yesterday our economists released the preview for the CPI, and I suppose that the major takeaway there is that when you look at the calculations that Taylor has done, the emphasis here is that when we look at trim mean, which is obviously the important one for the RBA, is that we still expect it to remain pre-elevated. So 0.9% for the quarter and 3.8% year on year. So this is slightly, pretty much in line with what the RBA had been forecasting for the quarter. But importantly, it just highlights this idea that we're only seeing a gradual progress in terms of domestic pressures. And again, it's one of the reasons why we believe that the RBA will be one of the last central banks to look at easing, because the inflation dynamics, particularly the domestic ones here in Australia, are taking a little bit longer to play out in terms of easing. And therefore, for now, we still think that the RBA maybe look to ease towards November this year, if not later, unless, we see an improvement in this inflation dynamic.
Well, it's a very different story in Europe, isn't it? The ECB minutes yesterday provided more evidence for the June cuts. So a couple of quotes from those minutes. Members expressed increasing confidence that inflation was on track to decline sustainably to the 2% inflation target in a timely manner, whatever that was or is. And whilst it was wise to await incoming data and evidence, the case for considering rate cuts was strengthening. I mean, so okay, they didn't say explicitly, so June it is then, but close to it, aren't they?
Yeah, close enough, and close as close as you might get from a central bank as well. So I think that the narrative from the ECB has been supported by the recent data releases. And the market now is pretty comfortable with the idea that a new easing cycle will begin in Europe in June. In that sense, I think that the debate now should begin to shift, if not already, to the reality that we have an economy that's still not performing very well, sort of trending around zero in terms of growth. The outlook is for a big improvement towards 1.5 next year, but we haven't seen yet that evidence. There's some green shoots in terms of the PMI and activity, but then the question is, do you have inflation declining? Inflation declining and an economy that is not yet firing? Then the question is, well, how much should you be easing by? And that is, I think, is a big question for Europe. Know that they're going to begin easing. How aggressive is the ECB going to be? especially bearing in mind that there's the risk that the Fed may, you know, may not cut as soon as many expect.
Yes.
And that, will, of course, will be important for the euro.
So it could be June and then a bit of a wait. Yeah, so PMIs, revised up a little bit in most countries in Europe, except for the UK, which was actually revised down, perhaps no surprise. Europe's retail sales later today as well for February, they're expected to fall a bit. But obviously that's not going to change expectations for the ECB, is it?
No.
The fact, you know, it reaffirm June, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah. If anything, I think that the ECB, just as Lagarde and Lane and others have said, is around that wage growth dynamic. One of the sort of weird stuff, if you like, from the pandemic is that we've seen, you know, Germany basically in a technical recession and or stagnating at best, and same story for many European countries. And yet unemployment rates are super low. So that's kind of a strange. And one of the things has been sort of this also this buoyant wages growth. And that's a concern for the ECB, I think, between not only when they begin cutting or how quickly they cut. So I think that will be the important data ahead of the June meeting.
So we've got non-farm payrolls tonight. Of course, in the US, we had jobless claims. They ticked up a little last night, 221,000 last week from 212,000 the week before. That was a bit more than expected. We also had the Challenger job cuts, which also rose in terms of the number of cuts, job cuts. So aligned with those jobless claims from 84,600 to 90,300 in March. So over 257,000 cuts in the first quarter, 16% of those were in big tech companies. In terms of new jobs in tech in that quarter, just 2,237 for the whole of the United States. That was the lowest level since 2016. But hey, their share prices are doing all right, aren't they? But it's going to be interesting to see what non-farm payrolls does tonight. I mean, I guess that is, as you said, that is why the markets are a bit jumpy today.
Yeah, we've seen that. And if anything, obviously we mentioned this idea that bond yields are falling and equity markets are also going south in the last hour. But when you look at the price action around that jobless claim number, it's interesting to see, you know, yields were rising. And then we saw a 7 basis point drop in the 10-year rate. With the number of initial claims coming a little bit higher than expected. And as you say, there's a few dynamics going on here in terms of not just those initial claims, but the Challenger data suggesting that some weakness should be expected ahead. And then there's also been quite a bit of a write-up around California in particular, where the increase in the minimum wage is expected to trigger a loss of jobs. Many think that it could be as high as 90,000 jobs. And also have an influence in the unemployment rate at the national level. So, what is interesting here, of course, is that from a Fed dynamic, the ideal scenario of the soft landing is that you see a little bit of softness in the labor market, whilst inflation also starts heading south. And you know, we had just Fed Chair Powell talk about that and mention the idea that, you know, whilst inflation is the main concern, you know, any further weakness or weakness in the labor market would become something that the Fed will consider in terms of its rate outlook. So
what is the most important? Yeah. So what's the most important number to look at then? Is it the actual number of jobs or is it the move in average hourly earnings?
I think it's the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate is the most reliable number in all of that. You know, remember the volatility in jobless and jobs is super high, and then you have these revisions and so on. And what we've seen, of course, is that unemployment rate ticked up from 3.7 to 3.9. The market is expecting a move down to 3.8. But what is interesting, you look at the distribution of forecasts, and there's quite a lot of people suggesting that 3.9 or even a 4% unemployment rate could be seen tonight. So that will be important because you see yet another month showing this weakness in the labor market, particularly reflecting the unemployment rate, and that will embolden the idea that, you know, the Fed can start preparing itself for a new easing cycle.
Now, trade data, we've got Australia's trade numbers today. We had a bit of trade data yesterday in the US. Exports and imports both picked up a bit in February. The same for Canada, who had actually the strongest export growth in 6 months. A chunk of that was gold exports. You know, we've been seeing the gold price, right? I don't know where this gold is going. It's someone somewhere in the world is obviously worried about total economic collapse and they're buying it all up. But Australia's trade numbers today, along with the final read for February retail sales as well. So, I mean, with these commodity prices rising, presumably we're going to see a good balance of trade.
Yes. So our economists expect a nice $11 billion surplus, particularly helped by an increase in iron ore exports. As you say, one of the dynamics, of course, and one of the reasons why the Aussie dollar is at 66 cents today, notwithstanding that risk aversion in the equity market, is because the rise in commodity prices, excluding iron ore, we've seen a broad gain in prices, particularly metal prices, copper, and that is reflective of the market pricing this increasing activity, so an improvement in global growth, and that, of course, is very important for the Aussie dollar. So that dynamic is very encouraging. And just as a small comment on gold, gold is getting this extra bid because there's quite a lot of evidence now suggesting that we've seen, you know, central banks from China within the BRICS as well as the Middle East buying gold. And there's a reflection there of some diversification away, if you like, from US dollar assets. And that's certainly playing into the gold, which is, you know, essentially just breaking charts and breaking high quite significantly.
Is this to support their BRICS currency, their BRICS trading bloc? Is that the idea? Anyway, that's a conversation for another day, isn't it? Look, we get Japan's data today, the coincident index and the leading economic indicators index. I'm not quite sure I totally understand the coincident index, but it fell very heavily in January, I can tell you that.
Yes, I think the leading index will be important because, again, the Tanken survey is suggesting that we should expect a continuation of the buoyancy in terms of economic activity, but more in particular, driven slowly starting to emerge from the domestic side. And that's where also household spending data today will be important, because if you remember, the Bank of Japan talks about this virtuous cycle between wages and prices. And for that to happen, you need to have a consumer be willing to spend money, even now that they're getting paid more money. And we haven't yet seen that. So the consumer remains quite anemic, but now that they're getting paid more, hopefully they start spending more as well.
All right, that's about it. Thanks very much. We'll catch you soon, Rodrigo.
All right, cheers, Phil.
And of course, later on today, it's the weekend edition. We look at how China is treading a very delicate path between decoupling itself from the West whilst trying to attract foreign investment. How's that going to work? Diana Choyleva talks through their strategy.
The moment Xi Jinping came to power, China started decoupling itself from the world. And once Donald Trump came to power, which by itself, the election, this populist result, whether it's Brexit here in the UK or the election of Trump, was also, I would argue, the result of the global economy sort of inability to make this globalization work on this premise of two very different systems and neither one converging on the other.
Diana Choyleva from Inodo Economics in London, a China expert, talking to us on the weekend edition, which is available this afternoon from wherever you picked up this podcast. It's going to be in exactly the same place. It's also where you're going to find Monday morning's edition of The Morning Call as well. So please join me for both of those podcasts. I'm Phil Dobby for NAB. Have a fantastic weekend. I'll see you soon.